Robin Young, it's here and now. In a moment, is it a good idea to attack a campaign ad featuring an actor who suffers Parkinson's disease? We'll have that story. But first, politics formed the backdrop this morning as President Bush held his second solo news conference in 2 weeks, a day after top U.S. leaders in Iraq announced a timetable for improving security there, an idea the Iraqi prime minister dismissed today, calling it a midterm election tactic. Well, in the White House this morning, President Bush said he was not satisfied with the way things were going in Iraq. And NBC reporter David Gregory asked why he's no longer using the phrase stay the course regarding Iraq.
In the past, Democrats and other critics of the war who talked about benchmarks and timetables were labeled as defeatists, defeatocrats, or people who wanted to cut and run. So why shouldn't the American people conclude that this is nothing from you other than semantic, rhetorical games, and all politics 2 weeks before an election?
David, there is a significant difference between benchmarks for a government to achieve and a timetable for withdrawal.
Well, joining us from Washington is Linda Feldman, White House correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. And Linda, we spoke about this on our program yesterday, this problem with language that the Republicans in the White House might be backing into. What needle is the president trying to thread here? What was that difference, did he say?
Well, he's employing a classic campaign strategy, which is to slightly mischaracterize the opposition's position. He says the Democrats have been proposing an artificial timetable, when in fact, what really everybody is on the same page. Everybody wants benchmarks. Everybody wants actions by the Iraqis and evidence that things are progressing and moving forward. And so, but we're 2 weeks before an election and they need to kind of hype differences or at least the appearance of differences.
What was your sense of why the press conference was called? I mean, what was the thrust of it?
Well, the thrust obviously was to talk about Iraq. It's been a terrible month, big U.S. casualties. We're 2 weeks away from an election and this is essentially the president making a campaign speech with the Washington Press Corps.
And saying what? I mean, did he acknowledge a majority of Americans are dissatisfied with how things are going?
He did. I mean, he is having to thread the needle in terms of presenting a picture of reality that he understands how tough it is over there and how things there's just been a lot of bad news. But he's the ultimate optimist. He just is continuing to put forth a representation that things can get better and that he's going to stick it out, that if we pull out, that's automatic defeat, where as long as we're still in there, he's hopeful that we can wind this up in some kind of positive fashion.
Was President Bush asked about the Iraqi prime minister's comments today? Nouri al-Maliki said, no one has the right to impose a timetable on the Iraqi government. And the prime minister also said he wasn't concerned about the talk of deadlines that we heard yesterday, because it's right before a U.S. election and so he sort of was dismissive of it as, oh, that's just how they talk over there, seeming to completely undermine the news from yesterday.
Yes. Well, the president said he hadn't read the transcript of al-Maliki's press conference, so that was his way of not discussing the content. And he also was asked why al-Maliki did not appear at a press conference with the American ambassador, Zalmay Khalilzad, and with General Casey, the head of the U.S. operations over there. And, his quip was, well, I don't plan their press conferences. But clearly, there's, discord between the Iraqi government and the American forces over there. And, everybody has their own political stakes here. Al-Maliki cannot be happy with a raid in Sadr City because he needs to represent all Iraqis. This is the raid was taken against a very important power center over there, and the U.S. understands that. There's a little element of kabuki theater here where they can't be seen as being too close. The Iraqi people can't see al-Maliki as being too close to the Americans.
Linda Feldman, White House correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. Linda, thank you.
Great, thank you.
Well, in the news conference, President Bush was asked about the midterm elections and the thinking that Democrats just might gain control of the House, maybe even the Senate. The president said, Democrats are dancing in the end zone but haven't scored a touchdown yet. Well, our next guest will agree, as you'll hear. He's Los Angeles Times reporter Ron Brownstein. His paper just released a new poll today showing Democrats need to clinch at least two of three Republican-leaning states states to take control of the Senate, although this is the first major poll to show Democrat Jim Webb ahead of Republican incumbent George Allen in the Virginia Senate race. Ron, welcome, and let's start with that. Allen has been struggling in Virginia ever since he was accused of making a racial slur against a Webb campaign worker. So has the tide turned irreparably against Allen?
No. I mean, I think at this point, I mean, I don't go to the bank on any single poll, including our own. But what you were getting consistently in the polls is a race that was within reach for both candidates. Two other polls in the last few days have had Allen ahead by 2 or 3 points. We have Webb ahead by 3 points. Clearly, it's a much more competitive race than it appeared at the beginning of the year. But by no means is it safe for either man at this point.
Or overall, what jumps out at you looking at these numbers?
Well, I mean, what it says is that the Democrats really are on the edge of putting together the states they need to take back control of the Senate. But to get there, that last mile is going to be very difficult. They have to cross some very Republican terrain. You know, right now, most polling shows Democrats leading for Republican-held seats in Montana, Pennsylvania, and Rhode Island. We didn't poll any of those. If those all hold up, if Democrats take those three, then they need three more to get the majority. We show them winning in Ohio. We also show them holding on in Tennessee at the moment, where Bob Menendez has a more narrow lead against Tom Kaine Jr. in a state where the president is very unpopular and is a weight on the Republican. So if all of that breaks toward the Democrats, they must win 2 of 3 in Missouri, Tennessee, and Virginia to get the majority. And what we show is that this is tough terrain for Democrats.
Well, specifically the rural terrain. Tell us more about that.
Well, Republicans continue to have big leads among the cornerstones of the culturally conservative coalition that have moved these states in their direction over the last decade or so. The Republicans lead big in rural voters in Missouri, Tennessee, and Virginia. They're still leading among white men by big margins, and they're still leading among white voters who go to church regularly by big margins. Democrats don't have to win those constituencies, but they do have to hold down the margins a little bit, more than they've been able to do in the last few years in order to get over the top.
Well, what does it show about how Democrats should campaign regarding President Bush?
Well, you know, the president, I think, is clearly a weight on the Republicans in New Jersey and Ohio, certainly in Pennsylvania and Rhode Island as well, which we didn't poll. But in these other states, it's more equivocal. I mean, this is the reality, the difficulty the Democrats face in converting a broad national sentiment into wins in the specific states they need. In Missouri and Tennessee, his approval rating is much higher than it is nationally, nearly 50%. And in Virginia, it's, you know, a good 5 or 6 points higher than it is nationally. So the question is, in all of these states, the president is not nearly as strong as he was in 2004. Does he retain enough strength to help Republicans over the line? Because when you look at all of these states, there's a very clear correlation. About over 80% of the voters who say they approve of Bush are voting Republican, and somewhere about 70 to 80% of the voters who disapprove are voting Democratic. So where he stands matters a lot.
You did touch on this. The Republicans are hoping to pick up a Democratic seat in New Jersey. What are the pitfalls there?
Bob Menendez, the Democratic appointee to replace John Corzine, who was elected governor, is a flawed candidate. He's been tagged with all sorts of scandal issues. But Tom Kaine is running against the headwind of deep unpopularity for the president and the war in New Jersey. And that really is the hammer that Democrats have used to hold down Kaine, the argument that a vote for Kaine ultimately empowers Bush by making it more likely that Republicans will maintain control of the Senate.
Ron Brownstein of the Los Angeles Times with new polling material out just today. And, of course, anything could happen in the next few days. Ron, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, as Ron just mentioned, Tennessee is one of the races that Republicans need to hold on to hold on to control of the Senate. Former Chattanooga Mayor Republican Bob Corker faces Representative Harold Ford Jr. Ford, hoping to become the first African-American elected to the U.S. Senate from Tennessee since Reconstruction. Joining us now, Roger Brown, Chancellor of the University of Tennessee at Chattanooga. Welcome, Chancellor Brown.
Thank you very much. I'm happy to be here.
Well, as you know, there's been some controversy here, especially around some TV ads. Let's take a listen to one. It was produced and funded by the RNC. And in it, there is a white woman who seems to be flirting with Ford. She's coquettish, somewhat like a Playboy bunny. Let's listen.
I met Harold at the Playboy party.
I'd love to pay higher marriage taxes.
Canada can take care of
Harold, call me.
Well, Chancellor, this alludes to a Super Bowl party that Harold Ford apparently attended. The party was thrown by Playboy magazine. How is that playing in the region, first of all?
I think it's pretty controversial here. We have a state that's closely divided along partisan lines with the state legislature about 50-50. It isn't a state that is hardcore either right or left. And I think this ad probably is over the top for many Tennesseans.
It's been criticized by Democrats and Republicans, including former Senator William Cohen, who says that it's an attempt to insinuate an interracial relationship, hoping to, you know, spark a response from rural voters.
I believe that's going to cause some backlash against this ad. Tennessee is not used to such rough and tumble in its typical political advertising.
Well, Bob Corker, the Republican candidate, has called on local TV stations to stop airing the ad, so he may agree with you that there may be a backlash. Well, meanwhile, there's another television ad put out by the RNC. Ford himself has said this might have racial overtones because it has a dark, shadowy figure that sort of looks like the congressman walking, you know, down a dark alley. And Ford told the Chattanooga Times Free Press that he thinks this may have injected a little race into the race. And then there's also a fundraising letter, which has also been criticized. It was sent out by Republicans. It's said to use code words with an altered photo of Ford made to make him look darker. First of all, what are those code words?
We're talking about the liberal and family business. The family business, of course, refers to the fact that Representative Ford has several relatives who have also been in elective office, some of whom have had some scandal in their careers. When one refers to family business in Memphis, it's sometimes interpreted as an attempt to tie this to African-American politics in Memphis.
Harold Ford's father served as a congressman for 22 years. Seven other family members have held office, and three Fords have been indicted. But in a debate in Chattanooga, Corker focused on Ford's father and his decision to become a lobbyist for Fannie Mae after leaving Congress. How did Ford react to that?
He reacted, I thought, very strongly. In fact, it was one of the strongest exchanges during the debate. And Mr. Ford simply said, "Please don't bring my family into this debate. It has no place." But, of course, it has not stopped.
Peter Canellos, who's a columnist here in the Boston area, has written that Harold Ford has pretty much kept the race card in the deck. What do you think?
I really believe up until now both candidates had avoided the race question very effectively and focused very much on the issues that the whole country is looking at. But as the race tightened up, then I think the races have both went to what they thought were the hot-button issues, and certainly still in the border south, race is one of those issues.
And by the way, from Harold Ford's side, what are some of the things he's saying about Corker?
The Ford campaign has focused on the fact that there were some tax increases while Mr. Corker was mayor, and that he had a construction company in which some illegal aliens were identified, and Mr. Corker's company was cited for that.
Chancellor Roger Brown of the University of Tennessee at Chattanooga talking about the fierce race for the U.S. Senate in Tennessee between Republican Bob Corker and Democrat Harold Ford Jr. Chancellor Brown, thanks so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And just ahead, Rush Limbaugh has made fun of Michael J. Fox, the actor, in an ad for Democrats with Michael J. Fox asking for more stem cell research. How much is that going to backfire on the Republicans? Much more coming up here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Campaign ads are always meant to provoke, and this midterm election has been no different. Conservative radio host Rush Limbaugh is drawing fire for his on-air criticism of an ad featuring actor Michael J. Fox, clearly suffering from the effects of Parkinson's disease. Fox asks viewers to support Democrat Claire McCaskill over incumbent and Republican Jim Talent in the Missouri Senate race because of McCaskill's support of stem cell research. First, let's listen to a clip from the ad and then Limbaugh's on-air reaction. Action.
They say all politics is local, but it's not always the case. What you do in Missouri matters to millions of Americans, Americans like me.
In this commercial, he is exaggerating the effects of the disease. He is moving all around and shaking, and it's purely an act. This is the only time I have ever seen Michael J. Fox portray any of the symptoms of the disease he has.
Well, and apparently the email started coming in. John Carroll joins us now. He's mass communications professor at Boston University and a longtime ad observer. John, Rush Limbaugh is usually worth the price of gold to Republicans. Did this backfire?
It did a little bit. Rush Limbaugh has pulled back a little bit on his statement. Mm-hmm. But I think that there's a whole nother school of thought here that says Michael J. Fox has appeared that way before, that he intentionally held back his medications before testifying before Congress on Capitol Hill not too long ago. He and Michael J. Fox admitted that to a degree. So he leaves himself open to this kind of criticism. I think Rush Limbaugh took it too far, but there was a seed there.
Well, and then others have come to Fox's defense and said, well, sometimes the bobbing and weaving is the side effect of the medications.
Yeah, this is one of those issues that sort of crosses party lines. A lot of it has to do with people's personal situation, and if they have someone in that medical condition or a similar situation who would rely on stem cell research, that becomes a big issue, and politics sort of gets stripped away.
All right. Well, we want to touch on some other ads. Democrats have created several where they try to tie candidates to President Bush, including one we want to listen to, and visualize people literally walking up to a garden bush and asking these questions. Let's listen.
Why won't Congress do anything?
Pass a decent minimum wage.
Why are we losing so many jobs to overseas?
Okay. It's kind of ridiculous to think you're ever going to get an answer from this bush, but it's also kind of ridiculous to think you're going to get an answer from this one.
And of course, at that point, you see a picture of President Bush. It's an ad created by the September Fund, a new 527 organization started by former Clinton advisor Harold Ickes, taking aim at a sitting president. Does that have the possibility of backfiring?
I don't think it backfires so much as it's a little bit off target. A lot of candidates are out there, Democratic candidates, running against George W. Bush, and that's not really the issue. They are trying to tie other candidates and issues to George W. Bush because his favorability is so low these days. But I think that what happens is they get sidetracked. This is a sight gag that's fun for about 10 seconds, and after that it starts to seem a little bit silly and detracts from the message.
Well, we've been watching one race in North Carolina where Republican candidate Vern Robinson, an African-American, is taking on Democrat Brad Miller in the 8th Congressional District. Robinson is putting his ads on the video sharing website YouTube. But again, let's listen to Vern Robinson's ad.
These illegal aliens pay no taxes but take our jobs and our government handouts, then spit in our face and burn our flag. Well, Vernon Robinson has had enough. Vernon Robinson is an Air Force Academy graduate who proudly served in uniform under the American flag, the flag Brad Miller voted to let illegal aliens burn and trample.
This is a remarkable ad because it starts out with a shot of a woman crumbling a letter, and it's an exact copy of an ad that ran in 1990 in North Carolina, run by Jesse Helms against Harvey Gantt, who was a black candidate. Huh. And it was a white woman who had not gotten a job because a black person had gotten it. Now it's a black woman who didn't get a job because a Latino got it.
And it's an ad run by an African-American.
Exactly. So the sort of societal shift is very interesting down there as far as what's happened in 16 years. Beyond that, I mean, this pushes every hot button that you can find in North Carolina.
Oh, you want to salute.
You want to salute or you want to go take a shower afterwards. Moderate people are going to reject an approach like this.
Well, there have been plenty of outlandish ads here in Massachusetts where we are. But one that we're going to concentrate on today actually isn't even running anymore. It was run by independent candidate for governor Kristi Mihos, running against Republican Carrie Healey and Democrat Deval Patrick and Green Rainbow Party candidate Grace Ross. They've all been taking aim at politicians for the handling of the Big Dig. People outside of Boston know the story of the slab that fell and killed a woman and the criticism of this huge construction project. But in this ad, and it's animated, an animated candidate, Mihos, asks engineers and politicians about the Big Dig. As he does, their heads disappear, well, you know, between their legs. Let's listen.
Mr. Engineer, why is the Big Dig $12 billion over budget?
Well, you see...
Okay, you get the idea. I mean, I'm sorry, parents, if your kids are in the car, but their heads are up their butts, I guess, is the message. It's pretty outrageous.
This is an ad done by Bill Hilsman, who does a lot of independent candidates. He did Jesse Ventura. In Minnesota. He's doing Kinky Friedman down in Texas in his ill-fated gubernatorial run. The problem is that Kristi Mihos is not a character like that. It trivializes further Christy Meaus's candidacy, which is unfortunate because I think he's trying to make a serious run, but I don't think this helps.
You mentioned Bill Hilsman. He also created an ad in the center of a referendum question in California. You want to take a quick listen. It's Proposition 89, which would severely restrict donations to candidates and limit corporate donations for ballot initiative campaigns to $10,000. It's funny that this ad is from a guy who makes so much money from making ads, and he wants to restrict them. But in this scene, there's a group of people going through a factory conveyor belt and being pounded down. Let's listen.
Rich politicians, political parties, and lobbyists keep pounding you with lies, distortions, and half-truths day after day with millions of dollars of ads until you believe their lies or get beaten down.
This is the blue plate special for the Supreme Court. I mean, if this ever passed, it would go to the courts and be tossed out immediately. I think this is a money is speech issue that the courts have already decided.
But will this ad set people to vote yes or no on 89? I mean, is it an effective ad?
I think it might be, although I think it's going to be. They're not going to spend enough money on it to make a real impression out there. There's a lot of advertising on the air. I'm not sure it's going to fight through the clutter.
John Carroll, mass communications professor at Boston University. Thanks so much.
My pleasure.
Let's take a quick program note here. Tomorrow on Here and Now, life begins at 40. Well, for some it does. We're going to look at why so many older men and women are signing up for military service. That's tomorrow. But stay with us. Much more ahead, Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In the 2 years since she won the Nobel Peace Prize in 2004, Kenyan Wangari Maathai has been busy. Her Greenbelt movement, the grassroots tree planting program she founded, which won her the prize, continues to thrive, planting more than 40 million trees across Africa and moving many Africans out of poverty. Also, after years of fighting the Kenyan government on both ecological and human rights fronts, she now serves as a member of the Democratic Kenyan Parliament, and she's written a memoir about her experiences. It's called Unbowed, which strikes us as much like her trees. And Nobel Peace Prize winner Wangari Maathai joins us in the studio. Welcome.
Well, thank you very much. It's great to be here.
A little belated. Congratulations. Has it worn off at all? I mean, because we remember when you won. It was stunning, frankly.
It was wonderful. It was, of course, very astonishing to many people. But we also know, if we follow the history of this organization, now more than 100 years, it has always shifted in an effort to expand our understanding of what is peace and security.
Well, and in the most recent prize, it went to Muhammad Yunus of the Grameen Bank for microfinancing, and that same kind of thinking was the economy and
yes.
peace.
Yes, indeed, because he has also devoted his whole life into addressing the issue of poverty through introducing ordinary women into the management of finance. To me, it's again an emphasis by the Norwegian Nobel Committee that the issue of good governance, the issue of good management of resources, and the issue of equity is extremely important.
And in your case, there were many of those issues were involved, but also the issue of restoring trees to a barren land. And explain to us, for those who somehow missed the hoopla, why was that equated with peace?
But when you study the Greenbelt movement, you see that there is more to it than just the tree. For example, we emphasize the need to manage the limited resources that we have in a responsible and accountable way. We demonstrated that you can't do it if you don't have a democratic system of governance that respects the rule of law, that respects diversity, that allows participatory system of governance. Just like we accepted that it is impossible to live in peace without respecting human rights, it's the same way with respect to the limited resources that we have on our planet. And when you think of all the conflicts we have, big and small, in the whole world, many of them are due to the struggle to access, to control, to manage those resources.
Yeah. And by the way, did I read at one point, or maybe even now, you have 10,000 women employed planting and nurturing trees in...
Well, we have hundreds of women who are self-employed planting trees. I say self-employed because we actually don't give them a salary. When they make those trees survive, a certain amount of the money that we get from our fundraising goes to compensating those women. Now, it is not only an incentive for the women to continue the work, but it also contributes to the income of the household.
I have this image in my mind of a woman desperately, you know, praying for rain or trying to keep animals or kids away from a sapling because this tree starts to mean so much.
Yeah, absolutely. And that is really the wonderful thing about this approach. And, you know, there have been many programs. Many people go and they establish such programs. The secret in this program was that we made it be a program for the people and by the people.
Well, I know what your goal was to take the Greenbelt movement outside of Africa. For example, I think of Haiti when I think of a deforested country. How has that progressed, if at all?
Well, it has been very difficult to do much in Haiti, but you'll be pleased to know that we are still pursuing that. And you can see what Haiti has done to itself. And the important thing is for Haiti, therefore, to understand that it has to restore itself. It has to restore its environment. It has to restore its governance to become more responsible, more democratic, so as to remove this conflict.
Are you saying because they don't? It has to be internal. They have to.
You have to have people in Haiti who are sufficiently committed to do the work. Mm-hmm. We indeed brought two people from Haiti. We brought them to Kenya. We exposed them to how we do it, how we mobilize people. They went back and they were not able to take off. We are starting again. We are trying again. I just want to say that it's easier said than done.
Well, at home in Kenya, you have had democratic change. You were elected to parliament. Have you seen a corresponding change in the landscape? Are there areas that have been re-greened yet?
Oh, we have been able to change large tracts of especially private land. These women literally transforming their land and giving themselves firewood and giving themselves fodder for their animals. I mean, it has been very satisfying to visit women who show you a house that has been built with the trees they planted, who show you their land and tell them how their land has become productive because now they are able to put in inputs and to grow food, and to show you landscapes where they, as far as the eye can see, you no longer can see, you know, houses because the trees are now 30 feet and higher. So no, we have been very blessed in the way we have transformed.
And the trees are blossoming, but so are the women.
So are the women. So are the women. And this process, without campaigning to men to respect women, I have come across men who don't know me, who speak very highly of the women, their wives, their sisters, who have done this great work of transforming their lands and transforming their lives. And so I have actually seen not only the women being very proud of themselves, but also men being very proud of their women.
By the way, it's a relatively small club of Nobel Peace Prize winners. Do you call each other? You know, how does it work? Do you ever get together?
I would say that the women Nobel laureate, we are very, very few in the history of the prize, but we have come together and we have formed a network, an initiative, Nobel Women Laureate Initiative, and we try to work together around an issue, for example, learning around those who are confronted by problems such as our sister Aung San Suu Kyi, because we definitely hope that one day she'll be able to join us.
She's the woman who's under house arrest in Burma, in Myanmar?
Precisely, and, yeah. You know, she has suffered so much behind closed doors, and it has been so many years, and she has never been able to come out and receive her prize. Her medal is still lying in Oslo. So we hope one day she'll be able to come out and get it and be able to go back to her country to continue her work.
Wangari Maathai, 2004 Nobel Peace Prize winner. Her new memoir is called Unbowed. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
And by the way, for more information about the Nobel Women's Initiative, go to our website, here-now.org. You're listening to Here and Now. If you're a cartoonist for the New Yorker magazine, you know rejection. For every 20 cartoons that are published in the weekly, about 1,000 get thrown in the reject bin. Well, now New Yorker cartoonist Matthew Diffie has rescued some of those rejects from the trash heap of history and published them in a new book called The Rejection Collection. It's a collection of the best of the worst, if you will, and Matthew Diffie joins us now with more. And Matthew, why did you do this? I'm guessing, was it because you thought your rejects were pretty good?
Well, yeah. I mean, as soon as I started submitting cartoons and getting most of them rejected, it immediately occurred to me, someday we got to do something with these.
And why are they rejected?
Well, there's just too many cartoons coming in. There's about, 40 or 50 of us regularly submitting, and that's not counting, the other people. So there's about 1,000 cartoons every week, so they only have room for 15 or 20.
And some are politically incorrect, too racy.
Yeah, certainly. The ones in this book, I think many of them couldn't have been in the New Yorker, really.
Well, I don't know. There's the woman in the full burqa with just her eyes. She's got her face covered.
That's Danny Shanahan.
Yes, a la Marilyn Monroe over the grate with the air blowing her burqa up.
Yeah, that one's probably a little too incendiary.
Yes.
As was the one by Alex Gregory with the guy being strapped on with a bomb strapped onto him and the other guy saying, is it too snug?
Right. Or here's another one from Shanahan with, I think this is one that graces the cover as well, with sort of the Bowery bum, former ventriloquist turned bum, sitting on the sidewalk drinking alcohol while his dummy does what?
Vomit.
Yes.
Yeah. Classy. Yeah, when I saw that one, I knew that was the cover image because I think it immediately sets up the sort of tone we're going for, cartoons that... Yeah, just the idea that we submitted them to The New Yorker adds an element of comedy.
I wondered about that. Is this sort of the part of the cartoonist that wants to be rejected? Because some of these...
What were we thinking?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, you can't necessarily edit yourself. You have to do these things. And, as cartoonists, we come up with funny ideas, and now we've got a place to put them.
Here's Drew Dernovich's a doctor handing a patient... A man, a glove, saying, give a man an exam, he'll be healthy for a day. Teach a man to examine himself, he'll be healthy for a lifetime.
Yeah, I understand that's based on a true experience. No. I think Drew's getting to be that age.
You got a couple more that come to mind?
Oh, I mean, all these are my favorites, but I love Mike Toohey's Home of the Bottomless Cup of Coffee with a waiter pouring coffee without any pants on.
That's right. You also have questionnaires for the cartoonists, which are equally hilarious. I'm looking at Gay and Wilson's. You ask them, for instance, to identify an ink splot. It's the ink splot
test.
What does this ink splot look like? He writes, a carefully drawn ink blot.
Yeah.
He's
a critic, isn't he?
So
I love the questionnaires. That's actually sort of my favorite part of the book because you don't get to see. I mean, most people don't even know what the cartoonists look like. So we have a photograph of everyone and then sort of an inside glimpse at how they create stuff and how they think. That's my favorite part of the book. Yeah, I wanted the book to sort of have this sort of rowdy atmosphere that all the cartoonists have when we go out to lunch every Tuesday. Just talking and trading quips. And
sorry, every time I see one, here's the two women, in balletic style, leaving the table at dinner in a restaurant, and it's entitled Women Synchronized Peeing.
Yeah, that's Eric Lewis, one of my good buddies. We talked for a long time whether it should be peeing or urinating, just to give you an idea of what cartoonists talk about, and I think we ended up with peeing.
Well, I'm just wondering, how proud are you all of these? Are these the ones that, even though they couldn't have got, is this something you guys have been talking about for a while? You should have seen the one that didn't get in?
Oh, sure, yeah. We've been even showing them to comedy crowds, and, you get this validation that, yeah, that was funny. So, yeah, some of these, they're obviously very inappropriate for the magazine, but that makes us, it entertains us probably more than some of the other stuff that's in the magazine. I think, for the most part, Bob Mankoff, the cartoon editor, does get it right, but some of these are just, outrageously funny, and I think, it could help the magazine to have some really outrageously funny ones.
Yeah.
But there is a line, and I'm sure these cross it.
Matthew Diffie, the editor of the Rejection Collection, cartoons you never saw and never will see in The New Yorker. To see some of the cartoons, the least offensive ones, go to our website, here-now.org. Matthew, thanks so much.
Oh, thank you very much.
Stay with us. More ahead here now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. They were forced to leave their homes in a small West African country rich in diamonds and minerals but cursed with corruption and conflict. For 11 years, Sierra Leone was embroiled in a barbaric civil war fought in part by child soldiers. The war ended only after the largest mission of UN peacekeepers in history gained control. By that time, some 2 million people had fled.
You left your country to seek refuge in another man's land. You will be confronted by strange dialects. You will be fed with unusual diets. You got to sleep in a tarpaulin house, which is so hot. You got to sleep on a tarpaulin mat, which is so cold.
6 of the refugees came together in a camp in Guinea, and with a few improvised instruments, the Sierra Leone Refugee All-Stars were born. Singer Ruben Karoma's father was macheted to death. His elderly mother died, feet incredibly infected after walking miles to escape. Harmonica player Mohamed Bangura's wife was killed in front of him. He was forced to kill his own child. Then his hand was cut off. Rapper Black Nature's father was killed. He was separated from his mother when he was 11. He's not sure he would recognize her today. A film of the band playing refugee camps throughout West Africa came out last year. Now they're touring the U.S. to tell of the refugee experience. And Ruben Karoma, leader of the Refugee All-Stars, joins us from the Carnegie Hall Studios in New York. Welcome.
Yes, well, I'm here.
And Black Nature, I understand, is with you?
Yes.
I'm understood. I can greet you by saying, how the body?
The body fine.
Yeah, the body fine. Black Nature, I'm wondering, you know, you left so much behind, including your mother in Sierra Leone. What was it like for you to find this band in the refugee camps?
Well, the band done great things for me because comparing the way I was in the refugee camp, I was totally traumatized. Yeah, I was totally traumatized. Mm-hmm. But because of started playing music together with the elders, that makes me to forget a bit what has happened to me.
But I'm wondering, here you are, you tour the refugee camps and you sing about the things that, you know, they remember. Let's listen to a song. It's about some of the forces that made the war happen in the first place. Everybody wanting to have their own belly full. Let's hear Bull to the Week.
Everyone is hungry. They want a belly full, yeah. The clerks want a belly full. The police want to belly full. The soldier want a belly full. Politicians want to scoff themselves. All them suck from the pores of the roads of my land. All them suck from the pores of the roads of my land. I got low wail and cry.
I understand now that even with a shaky, tenuous peace in Sierra Leone, a lot of the child soldiers who had, you know, hacked people up with machetes are now riding around on motorcycles given to them by the UN to help try to pacify them. You know, what's that like for people in Sierra Leone to confront the same people who slaughtered their families?
We cannot keep on fighting all the time, you know, trying to pay them back their debts. I think it will be a continuous fighting. People learn to forgive in our country. I think that's the best way.
Black Nature, I'm wondering, do you really think that that can happen? That, you know, it sounds so hard. I mean, how can you go back? Won't you be suspicious of your neighbor?
To be sincere, and I think I'm not going to find the person that who did this thing to me. All I have to do is just to forgive. I'm not going to forget, actually, but I will forgive. You know, and I will not be concentrate on looking for the person who did this thing to me.
Ruben, you know, the people say that in the film, too. It's pretty amazing. What's it like when you tour here, by the way? I mean, especially having lived in refugee camps, having, you know, seen the horror of what happened in Sierra Leone. Do you find yourself looking around and saying, this can't be on the same planet?
It's really amazing, you know. I know that it's not magic. It's just hard work and unity. So sometimes if I look at these places, I admire them. That's you know, in honesty, in hard work, you know, wonders may happen. And now look at us, touring the United States, Canada, Japan, you know, just like somebody taken from the slums to a show glass.
To a what?
A show glass. If you take like a precious stone, like a diamond, you put it on a show glass for people to see and buy it.
Ah, like a showcase.
Come on. There is a song which is called Garbage to the Show Glass. Because a refugee situation is just like a garbage.
Let's listen to the word.
Oh yeah, they found us in a garbage and put us in a show glass. Biggie, 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 say, I say.
Come from the best time in a biggie, biggie time.
Will you sing it more and more? Sing it more and more. A biggie, biggie time, I say now.
That's an amazing thought, to think of yourself as, you know, garbage, resurrected from garbage. But, you know, you really had nothing. When I think of you in the refugee camps, can you explain that, how you tried to make music when you had no instruments?
I can say that all instruments come from the brain of man. You know, so if there are no instruments, then you can play the instrument with your mouth, like what I did in living like a refugee. I don't have keyboard, so what I did, I just say, something like that. We can create drums with our mouths, you know.
One last thing I want to ask you. Soda Soap. We want to listen a little to that cut, but what is Soda Soap?
Soda Soap is a local made soap. But when things were normal in our country, people seem to overlook it. They say, but this soap is not good. You know, Sierra Leoneans, they like other things that come, especially from America, from England, you know. There was a time when no ship was coming in the country. There is no shop that is open during that time, and people just look and say, oh, now we are going to wash with soda soap. Rich people even. The lesson behind it is that people should learn to respect what they can make themselves. What you can make can be very cheap.
And come in handy when your country falls apart. Ruben Koroma, singer and leader of the Sierra Leone Refugee All-Stars. Their new CD is called Living Like a Refugee. They're now touring in the U.S., and you can find out where to catch them at our website, here-now.org. We want to thank you, Ruben.
Thank you.
We also want to thank you, Black Nature. We should say your given name, Al-Haji Jeffrey Kamara. Thank you so much as well.
You're welcome.
Some people that been the blob say they know they want sweet soda soap. Some people that been the blob say they know they want sweet soda soap. Soda soap.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again, Here and Now.
Some people that been the blob say they know they want sweet soda soap. Some people that been the blob say they know they want sweet soda soap. Soda soap, they put them closer. It ain't get them crop, crop. Small money, would I they want Rexona? Would I they want Sarah soap? Would I they want sweet flock soap? Would I they want sweet imperial soap?
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.